believers on that particular column and come back to us and say, look, you know, we actually did plenty of investigation and our target was 15 because we know that this is a real problem. And in fact, we ramped up our investigative capacity into that particular area. So, I mean, I think while we certainly, you know, congratulate on the continued work you're doing, I mean, there really needs to be a, you know, a more laser focus on that particular issue, because you know and I know that it's a very serious problem. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say well done for your audit, the clean audit. I also want to ask your professional fees. I want to know what those fees are for and why can't you do them in-house. And when it comes to enforcement, I want to know how that process works, because you've given all these compliance notices, etc., etc. But what is the process? I mean, do these compliance notices have teeth, or do they just write a letter to someone and they say you're fine and then, you know, ignore you until the next time you come on to inspect them? So I want to know how much power they've actually got, and do they actually make any difference at all? And thirdly, I just want to talk the same as the other honourable members were saying, your targets, you reach your targets and then you stop. And I think that you should start looking at your targets as a minimum, as that's the absolute minimum that you go for, and then after that, you move past it, because it seems that some of these things are very important, and like the other honourable members said, they're so important, in fact, if you reach a target, you shouldn't stop, you should continue, because we are an indebted nation, which is unsustainable, and needlessly attack the people that are lending money to people who can't afford it. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you. Just a few questions from my side. Firstly, I want to also commend you for achieving a clean audit. That is something which is very much important to us as government. One question is, you on your other targets and investigations where you investigated three large creditors. Who are those creditors which you investigated? And also, to agree with other members on these garnishing orders. Also, I don't know whether you have been in contact with Ms. Applebaum, who took the cases, who highlighted the very problem, which is a wide problem in our country. What awareness was, if you can go around right here in this institution, find the personnel and the staff, you go to schools, you go to hospital, all the civil servants, who's been there victims of these garnish orders? But in the mean, you find our departments being culprits, actually assisting in those things. These lawyers spoke as well, have sent letters, and then in the personnel or human resources department that is just implemented to that question. Are you maybe having any, you know, means of trying to make aware the departments on this issue? The other one is, what impact has the credit information amnesty had on the credit market itself since you started implementing it? What progress has the NCR made in addressing the identified challenges which you have just mentioned now? And what capacity is still required for the NCR to effectively enforce the amendments to the National Credit Act? Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you for those questions from Honourable Members. Let me start off and then I'll ask my team members to assist with some of the questions. Let me first of all start with the fees and insurance regulations and where we are with that. The regulations with regards to interest and fees were published for public comment and DPI, so in the assessment phase are still assessing the submissions. And with regards to the insurance, the credit life insurance cash, those regulations also still sitting with the National Treasury, and we are hoping they will be published, you know, very soon as final regulations, and perhaps the DPI they can give more information on that. The court case that passed on money and management orders in the Stellenbosch area, we sent our inspectors immediately to the Kimberley court to try and retrieve, you know, a lot of those documentations, especially credit agreements. We've also met with Wendy and the lawyer that was assisting, you know, the farmer in that area, and we will be working together with them. Our team investigations manager will be meeting with the lawyer next week in Stellenbosch to get some more information. And I would like Mr. Mashapa to, you know, to respond more on that, because he's been very close to that particular case. The huge drop in fees, we had anticipated that by mid, at least by the first quarter of last financial year, that we would have started registering, you know, the smaller credit providers as required by the amendments. We had hoped that we would have registered, for instance, the payment distribution agencies, the alternative dispute resolution agents, and unfortunately the regulations were only published in the last quarter of the last financial year. So hence, you know, the drop in the fees. But what we intend to do also to make sure that we get more income into the organization is that we are reviewing, in the process of review, we have reviewed the fees that will be payable by registrants, and we submitted our proposal to the DKI in that regard. So we are hoping we can generate more income that way. What we've also done is that we have included an expiry date in all certificates that are issued to registered entities, so that we don't sit with, you know, certificates in the branch outlets where consumers wouldn't be able to know whether they are still registered or not. Once a registrant has not paid their renewal fee, their registration lapses. And therefore it's important to also, you know, for us to be reflected in the on the registration certificate, which is supposed to be displayed in the business premises. So hopefully that will also help or at least alert consumers to the fact that, you know, that particular registrant is no longer registered with the NCR. I had a concern from honorable members around and the fact that once we've achieved and exceeded our targets during the course of the financial year, we, you know, take our foot off the pedal. The reason is that normally what we would do is channel those resources, because we don't have, you know, enough capacity within the organization to do everything else that we need to do in this, you know, in the credit industry. We would normally channel those resources to other, you know, to the other work that we have to do. You know, in terms of credit matters, you know, there's always something new that happens, you know, in the industry. So we are in that regard, once we know we've achieved our targets, we would channel those resources to do other things, you know, that are important and crucial, and to make sure that consumers don't always end up, you know, having to be exploited. The enforcement notices, we have issued a number of compliance notices. Normally what happens in the normal course of, you know, our enforcement action is that we would, if the contraventions are not too serious, we would issue an instructional letter. If the registrant does not comply with that instructional letter, we then issue a compliance notice which would indicate areas of non-compliance, indicate when it is that they need to comply, and if they don't comply with the compliance notice, we then refer them to the National Consumer Tribunal. In most cases, those registrants end up, you know, complying, because the last thing that they want is they have to appoint lawyers to fight their cases at the tribunal. We see that, for instance, with the compliance notices that we issued against auto traders, where they had advertisements, legal adverts, inviting, that is, the consumers. We issued a compliance notice against them, and they removed those ads in their magazines, and they even sent us the magazines to confirm that indeed they have complied. I think, let me, in the, Looking, going through the other questions, I'm going to ask my team members to respond to some of those questions. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you, CEO. I'm just going to take note of the question that this was raised by the honourable member around the funding of the deficit. Partially, the CEO has applied the taxes on collection on our fees from the resident. Basically, how we are funding this deficit, yes, we do have the fund issues, the budget shortfall constraints. But as an NPP, we really do try to come up with a creative way on cost containment management to implement those. So how we are finding the deficit is also through budget cuts where we hold this on our spending. Yes, it sometimes has also if there are implications on our budget. For example, one of the creative ways that we have tried to implement is that obviously my team, they also touch on this one or access to this one, where we are trying to conduct investigations internally, you know, capacitating our internal resources, and also around the spending for these workshops, educational campaigns, where then we try to earmark provinces where our employees could do in and out of our shifts, you know, we avoid overnight shifts, and also target the towns where they could also be able to cover more than one province. So that you can say on that one. The Congress has also alluded to the fact that we have reviewed and submitted to the DGI the fees on our residents so that we can try to make up on the collection. And also the fact that you know it's also the national treasury discussion on cost containment measures that we have implemented it to the team. So and it's also yielding results as far as our spending is concerned. Yes, we are still engaging with even the DGI on the additional funding, and we were also reflected this on our 2017 MTEF submission. Just also respond to the question around the professional fees. What is the makeup of the professional fees? Basically, it's mainly the legal fees. The fees that you pay to the attorneys that represent or that take on our cases, and then also on the consulting that they normally do our specialized engagement. For example, we've just reviewed the cost of credit, so we had to engage the credit provider to assist us with that, as well as we have rolled out the human resource system, so we engage the service provider as well as the ICT disaster recovery. So this is just an example. So these are the consultant or the service providers that assist us on specialized engagement that we cannot do in-house. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, honorable members. On my side, I'm going to just give an update on the cases that we are dealing with now. As the CEO has indicated, we referred ATRA and Standard Bank for the credit that they granted through the Satin scheme the past few weeks. Yesterday, we referred JDG trading to the tribunal for also misleading credit insurance to pensioners and consumers of federal social grants. And what we are also concerned about in that case is we have consumers who are receiving disability grants from the government. They've already been certified to be permanently disabled. And in that case, we found that JDG sold them occupational disability cards at a time when they were already permanently certified, permanently disabled, and that's why they are receiving government grants. Members will also recall that about 2 months ago, We also invite Fin Bond Mutual Bank to the webinar for charging consumers excessive premiums. And we have been engaging the DGI to publish the credit life insurance regulations, because we don't want to get involved in premiums. We rather have a cap that applies to the industry. But we would like to give the members an assurance that where we find that the premiums are excessive, we will take on the cases. We are working on other cases with similar problems. Regarding the Western Cape High Court, in fact, we referred breach coverage, and one of the charges was using this illegal consent to judgment, where consumers consent to the jurisdiction of a court situated far away from where they work or live, and breach to our referral on review to the High Court. I think it was rejected. So we're still fighting in the High Court. And we also take a point, Honorable Hilouis, that we should do more on this emolument attachment orders. We are working on other cases where these orders were obtained in the wrong course, and we will base our application on the reasons that were given by Judge Desai. On the impact of the credit amnesty, I think we see more positive impact on the judgments. Some of the reports that we have seen was that during the amnesty period, around 100,000 judgments were removed from the credit records of consumers, and they didn't have to pay legal fees to have them removed. I think that was very positive. However, what we are also seeing is, as the regulator, we need to continue encouraging consumers to pay the credit that was granted recklessly. So we need to improve the payment behavior of consumers if we are to deal with this problem. At the same time, continue also to fight against credit providers that are engaged in reckless lending. I think on the capacity of the NCR to implement the amendments, I think we are almost very close to becoming optimal. We have filled that with some funding. However, I believe that with the capacity that we have, we can do more, and we are certainly willing to continue conducting industry-wide investigations. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, just trying to get the names of the credit providers of investigation to the removal of address consolidated information from the office. And in terms of just to add on, onto what Mr. Masaka has just said around the issue of funding, is there any more specifically around office? Honorable members will know that people are sitting there, and we are willing to continue to work as we are. However, we must, I think, recognize the fact that it needs to be all over the country, because credit affects everybody. And therefore, in as much as we want to make sure that we do investigations timely, we really need to capacitate our investigative team and our education officers, because they need to be all over the country. Currently, we're operating with about 5 or 6 education officers who are supposed to be all over. And we are trying as much as possible to make sure that we do our investigations internally without having to rely on, external lawyers. So that's I think that's in terms of, the capacity and funding to private of the NCR. But and we will continue to find creative ways, of delivering on our mandate and partnering with our organizations. For instance, last year we worked very closely with the National Consumer Commission in our education campaigns. We continue to work with the South African Savings Institute, to conduct education, campaigns, and we'll continue to do that. Thank you.
Any follow-ups, Honorable Helwes and Honorable Anne Williams?
Yes, thank you, CEO. So I'd like to suggest that, well, firstly, as I said, I think the targets are a bit low, so I'd really like to see when you come back to report to us next year that the targets have increased, both the targets have increased a bit. And, you know, just to reiterate that you shouldn't feel that you should stop when you've reached the targets. You should carry on going and do much more if you can. And then even if you have, I mean, I think the point of a quarterly target is that even if you reach the annual target in another quarter, it's still a quarterly target. So you should still try to meet that quarterly target apart from the annual target. So I would like to see that in future reports, please. And then if you could just follow up on the comments that you made about Lewis and JD Group, and give us some more detail about the credit life insurance abuse in those cases, because my understanding was that there is already, I mean, so there's not much money. I know that there's already caps. I know that you have regulations, draft regulations to amend them and make them stricter. They are already caps. Were they simply ignoring the existing caps, or what exactly was going on there? And then, how long does it actually take to get a decision from the tribunal? And when you do get a decision, please, you remember how close we were when you reduced the fine against Africa Bank from a massive amount, like, you can remind me what it was, I think it was 300 billion to 20 billion. If these guys get a big fine, please do not reduce the fine. They need to actually get up. And it sends entirely the wrong message to the industry. Every time they get caught red-handed doing these most disgusting things, they get away with a tiny fine of 20 million rand, which I promise you for a group the size of Lewis and JD is puny. So please, don't let them talk you into reducing the fine.
Thanks, Ken. Yes, I just want to talk on again, the people who don't comply. I'd like to know, do you pick up repeat offenders? In other words, then, for instance, somebody will contravene the regulations, will go to the National Consumer Tribunal, will get a fine, and then next year will just tweak their lending process a little bit and repeat offend. And I'd like to know, if you do, what happens to them, or do they just go through the same process again? And I agree with Honourable Hill Lewis about reducing of the fines. I think that's a huge mistake to make. These companies make a lot of money lending money to the poor people. I mean, they really do. It's a great thing to do, but not good for South Africa. So I think they should be hammered hard. But I want to know what happens to repeat offenders. I mean, for instance, you said you referred Absa and Stand Bank now to the tribunal. Have they been referred before? I mean, or do they just keep being referred, keep paying the money, the fines out of their petty cash, and continuing? So, thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Standard Bank and Apollo, this is the first time we've referred them to the National Consumer Tribunal. Can I ask Mr. Shabat to respond to some of these questions?
CEO, for Lewis, the conversations where they were sending lots of employment cover to pensioners and self-employed people. And you know, if you're a pensioner, you're not working, that's why you're a pensioner. So you can never claim under that cover. We also found that there is not occupational disability cover. In other words, if you become disabled to continue with your occupation. So if you're a pensioner, you no longer have an occupation. For self-employed consumers, it's business in general, like a dressmaker. I can't remember the others, but a dressmaker. That is a business. You must insure a business. You can't say you would pay out for an occupation because it's a business, it's not an occupation. For JDG, the same problem. And as I've indicated earlier, also people who are receiving government disability grants on account of being permanently disabled, JDG sold them occupational disability cover. That covers them for permanent disability also. And this happened at the time when they had already been certified to be permanently disabled. And we also found that they are charging consumers a club fee, which is not permitted in the Act. And the amounts are quite substantial per consumer, around 500 at lab fee. And for Finvault, it was the excessive premiums. You find that on a loan of, say, for example, 700 rand, the credit life premium is 128 rand. And when you work out the industry average premium, it's less than 10 rand per thousand. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. We do take note of the concerns around the quantity target. And the trade life insurance, in terms of trade life insurance, there are no caps yet, hence the regulations on introducing caps. But especially in terms of involved, we looked at the unreasonableness of, you know, the amounts that we charge, because that is covered in the Act. Thank you.
Thank you, CEO, and your team. And I'm sure as committee, we might want to engage with you again on concerns and issues raised by members, especially on penalties. I think that's a worrisome thing, because if penalties are put, those people have flouted the Act, have done wrong things, and they get reduced, it's not a good sign. But I'm sure as a committee, we might want to make a follow up on some of the issues which have been raised around that, and especially around the issue of these cash orders. It's in that case highlighted a very, very endemic problem here in the country. And you can just imagine that was only one sector of labor, the farmers, the farm workers. It might be worse in other sectors, but surely we will want to engage with you on that. Thank you very much. Members will proceed to the next briefing by NGP. We will give over to Ms. Kongwa. You will only introduce your team. Welcome CEO. Welcome your president.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to the Chairperson and honourable members. I'm here with only our Chief Financial Officer, who will complement and supplement in the matter of finance. We are presenting our status of performance and financial information as at the end of Q4, the financial year 2014-15. Chairperson, we just have a technical glitch with sound on the presentation. Yeah, we've removed it. Thank you for the indulgence. Chairperson, thank you for the indulgence. Summary, just to highlight the activities for the fourth quarter. Before doing that, I'll just backtrack. When the administrator came into office, the NGP had been faced with certain challenges, as we have presented before. That was at the end of Q2. In Q3, we began trying to get on with and keep up with deliverables that we had promised to do as the NGP. So by the time we get to Q4, the certain work we've been able to do in the area of research, there's a particular research project that had been cancelled but substituted with one on prevalence of gambling. The cancelled research project related to researching on the viability of what kind of proposals could come into the proposed National Gambling Amendment Bill, which we hope will be tabled before Parliament soon. So considering the fact that DCI themselves have then undertaken some work in that respect and have tabled the proposed policy on gambling, and our research project was then cancelled because we didn't want to duplicate the effort. We then undertook the prevalence of gambling and problem gambling research project, which basically looks at various patterns with regards to problem gambling and how then from a social and economic impact. And then we also began preparing to conduct our research to determine the social impact of illegal gambling with specific focus on online gambling and to determine the capacity required by NGP to combat illegal gambling. So those are current research projects that are still underway. NGP also then began participating in various collaborative law enforcement forums. And then we also commenced an application for forfeiture of unlawful winning to the state. I'm sure you are all aware that NGP had been in possession of unlawful winnings that are confiscated by the bank. This was held by the trust. The NGP trust that was erroneously registered is now being deregistered, and those funds are currently held by the NGP in a Standard Bank account. So in terms of the law, NGP is required to make application to court for forfeiture of these unlawful winnings. So that process then began in Q4. We wrote to the State Attorney's Office, and it's a way of court order ultimately then for such money to be forfeited to the state and would then go to the revenue fund. If the court finds that those winnings were not as a result of illegal gambling, then such money would revert to the hunter. We also began developing a register of illegal operators. This was a mandate and a request from the minister. It's not in the NGA as part of one of our registers, national registers that we are to oversee, but it's a new development because from the approach of combating illegal gambling, even online gambling, we were advised and it's imprudent that we actually are aware and keep track of an illegal operators register. Through the legislative developments, we hope to deal with this and get this listed as part of our national register. Currently, the national register does deal with excluded persons, deals with machines and devices and operators who are licensed. The NGP also continued to gather national gambling statistics and information regarding South African legalized gambling industry from all provincial licensing authorities. So what we will present here is basically the status as of Q3. Ordinarily, as we report to Parliament, our statistics would be a quarter behind because in Q4 we would be auditing the Q3 statistics. Currently, as we just come out of our Q1 performance period for the current financial year, we're busy auditing then the financial year end, or rather Q4 statistics. So for the purposes of the Q4 report, we have the Q3 figures. This slide basically just shows how the trends have proceeded.
increase in GDR in each quarter and a comparative view then provided. Perhaps something just to point out would be the fact that there was a decrease in gross gambling revenue in the bingo sector. And then the next one just gives you an indication, basically the distribution or gross gambling revenue generation spread amongst the provinces, amongst modes of gambling in all provinces. So the casino sector continues to dominate other gambling modes, and then the percentage share out of 100 then is reflected in the respective amount in terms of performance. So as of Q3, the total gross gambling revenue generated was 17 billion. And then this is the provincial geographic spread as at quarter three. So once again, you'll see Gauteng continue to account for the highest amount of gross gambling revenue generated. There was a new casino that had become operational in the Northern Cape, resulting in a total of 37 operational casinos in South Africa. As we come through to present our Q1 statistics, we'll also indicate that towards the end of March, early April, another casino was introduced in the Limpopo area. So currently, the total number of casinos totals 38. And then going on to our key challenges and proposed solutions, we did face challenges as the NGB. To date, we have been able to deal with some of them. Some we basically highlighted as we tried then getting along with basically capacity constraints, which impact on our ability to effectively reach out as broad as possible to sections of the community. So in quarter four, what we did, despite that challenge, we collaborated with the DGR to participate in public outreach and initiatives. This was held under the auspices of the DGR. Then we also pointed out the fact that we lack legal skills and their stress. This presents a major challenge in the regulatory environment within which NGB operates. Why the focus in legal skills is when we undertook to check basically what it is the NGB should focus on, and in terms of the act and as mandated by the minister, we it's an area we're looking into to focus on appointing inspectors to assist with generally prevention, detection of illegal gambling, as well as enforcement. So that is something we're currently working on. We did highlight previously human resource challenges. We filled in some of our posts that we identified as critical. For example, the chief compliance officer had resigned in September last year, so we've since appointed the chief compliance officer who will oversee the inspectorate enforcement functions, investigations, and compliance overall by the provincial licensing authorities. We filled also the position of senior manager human resources. We also we also recruited a game technologist, but it didn't affect an appointment, so we'll be re-advertising that position. Those are just a few to mention in respect to what we had previously presented to get us going in certain areas. And then a key challenge, yes, was also the tax, which existed as a separate entity. It was deregistered in October. The Master of the High Court gave us permission to go ahead and do that and pronounce on it. And then all confiscated winnings were then transferred into the NGB's separate bank account. And currently, as I indicated earlier, we have brought these matters before court. We've requested the assistance of the state attorney to assist us to begin processing these applications before court for ultimate confiscation of the funds, of the unlawful winnings to the state, or they revert back to the panda if it's found they are not unlawful winnings. And then, in terms of our indicators,
the first strategic objective, which was enhanced region and statutory advisory services, there are several achievements we had. With respect to the Section 65 advisory report, why we indicated there that we partially achieved was that during the fourth quarter, we had prepared the report with respect to proposals on challenges regarding concurrent the areas of concurrent jurisdiction between the National Gambling Act and provincial legislation. Thereafter, DGI had also began its work with regards to review of the National Gambling Policy, which we have also given input into. So we did not complete basically the quarterly deliverables, which should have ultimately then gone to the Policy Council. And then with regards to research, I think I've touched on it where we had planned a particular research, but we had to reprioritize to avoid duplicating efforts in that respect. In the compliance section, ordinarily our mandate is to consolidate the clear compliance evaluation assessments. We have not achieved this deliverable due to the resignations of the chief compliance officer, compliance strategy manager, which basically left one official in the compliance division. We have since capacitated the unit, and we even recruiting for more officials. So there was, for the fourth quarterly deliverable, we didn't achieve, and hence it's recorded that way. With regards to intervention and collaboration with other law enforcement agents, work continues in this respect. And then this just indicates an overview of progress in respect to risks in our risk register. A particular area was ICT policies, was an investigation that was conducted with regards to our environment and areas of improvement. So we were able to approve policies by the end of the financial year. And also, what was also impacting on information security was our outdated ICT servers, which we have since procured, and we've dealt with that. With respect to our audit implementation plan, and this is the progress as at the end of the financial year, we had a total of 134 findings, internal and external audit. 121 have been resolved, 4 were currently in progress as at the end of the financial year, and then 9 had not been addressed relating to annual financial statements. However, these have been addressed after the Auditor General's audit. And then on the finances, this basically gives an overview where we were as at the end of the financial year. And here, what we wanted to highlight to the committee is that there's been great improvement in this area. When as at the end of the previous financial year, NGB had been in a deficit. But we are happy to report that we did report a surplus for the first time as at the end of this financial year. So that was an improvement with regards to reduction in overspending and managing in that respect. The NGB also managed to secure an amount of 15 million for NGB. This came as a result of the minister's approval on recommendation of the administrators to renegotiate the terms of the contract that we had regarding the limited payout machines and for the NGB to derive revenue. So the NGB has at least a cash injection in that respect. This additional funding also will assist the entity in the area of combating greed and appointing inspectors to combat illegal gambling, which is something that we've not been able to do. Just to give an update also, the AG's audit has been finalized. The NGB received an unqualified audit. They are findings, and these are findings with respect to matters you are aware of in previous presentations, and we have reported previously, for example, the NGV Trust, which we did, it was erroneously registered, we deregistered it. A particular issue also was the fact that the AG, despite after deregistering the trust, we began consolidating the financial statements for both the trust and the NGV. It was a requirement for the NGV to have done it in previous years. So there are findings in that respect. There are also findings, supply chain management, irregularities and findings in that respect, which are related to the payment of board member fees, and that was previously reported on. There are also findings regarding the national gambling mandate, specifically in the area of the fact that the NGV didn't make applications before courts to have their unlawful winnings confiscated, despite presenting to the AG that we had began only in Q4, but that was not good enough because this is something that had not been done for a number of years, so we did have findings in that respect. And then third area of improvement in the financial performance was also the fact that we managed to not overspend. So at the end of the financial year, the NGV then reported basically 92% of its budget had been spent. The reasons for the savings were, you know, amongst others, cost containment measures then that we had put in place as administrators. For example, even traveling was cut down, and basically there was an impact in terms of venue management taking over. And then this just basically gives an overview of revenue and expenditure regarding the status of financial affairs at the end of the financial year. I'll just skip basically the compliance calendar, which is our commitment in terms of the PSMA and undertakings we made with the DG and the minister in terms of shareholdership and management. Then in conclusion, as at the end of quarter four, NGV was only able to achieve 62.5% of its planned Q4 quarterly targets. When we made an analysis basically overall of the achievements for the full financial year, NGV was able to achieve 69.2%. I know it doesn't appear on this slide, I was just adding it in because this was really just for the specific quarter. And then I've reported on the financial position. What also stands out is the fact that there was a reduction with respect to irregular expenditure, which reduced from 3.6 million to 1.9 million. We also have highlighted there that there are certain irregularly awarded contracts that we had to cancel to try and get out of this situation. And then with respect to a great portion of our mandate, which is monitoring and market share and market conduct, we've presented the two quarter three steps at the beginning of the presentation, but just to give an indication where the industry is at this point in time, compared to the previous financial, to the end of the financial year, GG growth in gross gambling revenue has doubled. From when we compare the end of 2014, it was sitting at 4.3%. At the end of 2015, gross gambling revenue has increased by 9.6%. We are busy concluding the audited figures, so this 9.6% may change. And then, although a figure that may change, but we can safely report based on figures we received from the provincial licensing authorities, is that for the financial year ending March 2015, a total amount of 23 billion had been generated as gross gambling revenue, and then 319 billion was wagered. That's basically the money that then partners are putting in, and at times would be recycled in terms of, you know, that's being placed over and over again. That figure is not static. So that's just to give an indication what we will most likely be reporting after the audited figures are finalized in a few weeks' time. And then with respect to direct employment, there's a figure of 19,994 permanent and temporary employment reported by the Provincial Licensing Authority for the financial year ending March 2015. And then with respect to broad-based black economic empowerment, that's what we usually refer to as a triple B status level in the dumping industry, and this is the mode and operator as provincial licensing authorities license. On average, you'll see basically we are working license to level two companies, and then we've just given you an indication there of each sector. For the casino, there's an average of level two. Within the toll area, there's an average of level two. The LTM operators, level two, and bingo operators, level one. So that's the end of our presentation. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable McPherson and Honorable Williams.
Thank you very much for the report and update. Look, I mean, I just want to say that, I think we all know the terrible position that the NGV came from, and I mean, it's always going to be a mountain to fix off those not just broken but smashed pieces by previous boards. So I certainly don't envy your task, but I'm still concerned that we don't, as members of Parliament, and even maybe yourself, I'm not fully aware of the extent of what we find. We still don't have the forensic audit report that we were promised we were going to have. We're all unaware of the critical matters relating to the inflated leases that you still occupy as the entity. But more importantly, we still don't know who's criminally liable for what. And that deeply concerns me. So my question to you is, where is that forensic audit report and where can we have it? Can you give us an update on the Shems contract? Because as I understand, that contract should have been, I hope it was withdrawn. Where are you in putting out a new RFP, and when is that process going to be completed? And I also have, Chair, a very serious concern with the risks that the NGV have identified. CEO, you'll be aware that certainly one of my biggest problems that I've had is the disjuncture between yourselves and the provinces. And I'm quite shocked to see that one of your comments there is the inadequate involvement of the NGV in making inputs in terms of the National Gambling Act. And that strikes me as quite bizarre, as that you are the entity that is charged with regulating the gambling industry, yet the involvement in the Gambling Act and certainly the new gambling policy seems to have been very limited. I want to know why that is, whether that's a failure on behalf of the NGV or a failure on behalf of the DPI, to engage you on that matter. And also with respect to the provinces which continue to implement their own laws, it seems strange that we all, and I'm going to use the example of EBTs, we all agree they're wrong, we all agree they shouldn't be happening, but they continue to happen in the provinces, and the minister seems powerless to do anything. The NGE seems to be powerless to do anything. And, I mean, the provincial gambling boards have been turned into cowboy associations, in my opinion. And I really think that the NGE needs to be at the forefront and focus of actually being at the center of gambling policy and gambling regulation.
I want to know, with respect to the research that was cancelled, why it was, and maybe Ms. Goltz needs to answer that question, because once again, you know, the NGB is charged with regulating the industry. It's my personal opinion that the DPI and EPI officials know very little about gambling, because I think you can just block the internet to stop online gambling, which is ludicrous in the first instance. But I mean, are you prepared to carry on that research? Because I would like to know how the NGB sees the gambling industry, and what inputs need to be made into that, and if called upon, could that research be resurrected? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chair. Okay. I've just got a little query about, you said that you've got a lack of legal skills on slide number 7, and then on slide 14 it says that you, on your professional and consulting fees, you saved R1 million. So I'd just like to know, didn't you put that R1 million as your legal fees? Why didn't you do that? You know, you said you got that problem with legal skills, and then you saved money on professional consultants, which is all very good. I mean, I'm more keen on saving money, but if it leads to lack of services because of lack of skills, then I think that's a bad thing. I also don't think that 62.5% compliance is very good. And obviously that's going to improve, and there seems to be some improvement. Also, R1.9 million irregular expenditure is still too high, and that figure must definitely be worked on to reduce that, because, is that a new figure? I mean, if it went down, you still have your irregular expenditure continuing, so you have to really look at that. And lastly, I might be wrong at this, but the BE status of the industry seems to be very slow in transforming. I might be mistaken with those numbers, 1 and 2. I'm not sure which is the highest. Is 1 of fantastic, it's 100% back owned, and 2 is not, I'm not sure of that. So I just want some clarity on that, BE statuses of the different sectors of the industry, if you can do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Just from my part, on the risk part, what progress has been made in dealing with the risk identified in the register, in the third quarter report? Can you explain to the committee the status of self-funding model? Then, what progress has been made with regards to the proposed actions to deal with the challenges identified in the last quarter, the third quarter report? Over to you, Zihu.
Regarding the forensic report, I'll have to ask the schools to give you an update, so I'm not able to comment. The last time we came to the portfolio committee, we did come and report with the minister on the preliminary findings, but I'm not in possession of what the latest update is. I'll ask the schools to assist in that regard. Going on to the MSF's contract, we developed the RSP, it was withdrawn, and then we had to reconsider where we were. So we had a technical advisor on board. We also had to consult the DTI in terms of agreeing how the process will unfold, because it's a tender that has huge financial implications. Considering the NGV's financial constraints, we had to speak with the DTI and Minister's Office to see how the process can be managed, and how the Minister's Office can help us from a quality assurance point of view, considering the constraints the NGV has and the fact that the NGV is under administration. So those are the discussions that have happened. Another thing that we had to do was to go back to the provinces. In terms of the law, we are obliged to
consult with the provincial licensing authority. So after reviewing the draft, we had to go back to the provincial licensing authority to have the sessions and get their input. They had also brought to the attention of the administrators at the time that the NGD had not reverted back to them after they had initially made input. So we have to fulfill and honor that obligation, and that was concluded recently in June. Where we are now is that we have begun planning. In fact, we have planned in terms of how to how the various procurement committees should be comprised, and we're trying to get some multifaceted procurement teams in place to ensure, you know, the full proper procurement processes are embarked upon. So that is where we are. Yes, it will require us yet again to have certain consultation with the DTI, considering our constraints. The DTI would assist us in availing expertise to form part of the lead, either the specification, evaluation, adjudication committees. In terms of the PSMA, we are allowed to source expertise from out of the NGV. It's a tender with huge financial implications, and we have only basically currently approximately 17 staff members. So some of them, the majority of them, who are at administrator, will perform administrative tasks. So for a matter with huge financial implications, we're definitely trying to get a certain level of officials from the DTI, from provincial licensing authorities who will assist us in that respect. So that's where we are, that we are moving. That then ties in with why a consideration had to be made to extend the current contract. We had hoped we didn't have to, but to the point we've gotten to, and the fact that the NGV had lost so many staff members, we were not able to continue the procurement process. So there was a consideration to extend the contract. We also had to weigh the potential revenue loss if there was any disruption if the contract had come to an end and was no operator in place, then the revenue fund or provincial revenue fund would have suffered great loss, considering the amount of taxes and levies that the LPM industry then is able to derive. Any disruption of service would be a big challenge. So those are various considerations that we have made. This, because of the magnitude of the matter, we did escalate to the minister's level. We were also advised to do that, and the minister then concurred on our recommendation for extension of that of the contract. So that's how then we resolve that it comes to an end in December 2016. We are hoping, and why we set that date is when we looked at the previous project plan, we are hoping to appoint the next operator by June next year. We did consult with industry peers who indicated that the transition process would take about 6 months, because in as much as it's a system, you would then provide, you actually have to go to each location to physically connect and check that each machine is actually compatible and connected to the system. So that process, we're told, takes a while, and hence the current contract could have been a year, but then we needed to cater for the transition process, and that then gave us an additional 6 months. The matter of the EBT is not able to say much apart from indicating that we are trying to deal with this issue. The matter of EBT has found its way into the national gambling policy. So there's definitely agreement in terms of EBT being permissible. DTI would be able to expand on this, but that's basically the policy position that DTI is entrusted with. We've also had
discussions with SABS, the Robotics and Bureau of Standards. We've also discussed with the provincial licensing authorities, because it's important that as we move, well, basically the GTI and the NGV move towards the electronic vehicle terminals, seeing their way through policy and then ultimately legislation, it's important that standards are then developed, yeah, because we don't currently have standards. So those are discussions we as the NGV specifically had with SABS two weeks ago. We're having the next provincial CEOs forum where the NGV also sits, end of August, and it's a matter of discussion again that we need to move with respect to that. On the development of standards, the industry is also involved and they are part of the working group voluntarily. So it might take a while, but at least we're trying to ensure that we get moving on that. And then the research that was cancelled, I was basically referring to the research we had planned for the financial year, at the beginning of the financial year. It was to assess and get an indication, you know, possible amendments that can be made to legislation. Considering the challenges that were within the NGB, the research units didn't move along. However, DGI had moved along, and that's what I was trying to explain. And DGI had done, you know, tremendous work with respect to development in the policy. So when we made an assessment whether we should go ahead so late in Q3, it didn't serve any purpose because DGI had already progressed. So it's not a situation where we're not able to do anything. We ordinarily work with the DGI on research projects because in as much as the NGB is an implementer, DGI sets policy which we implement. So we would always want to move at the same pace and have the same understanding where we are with issues. So historically, I think there was some communication challenges in that respect. And by the time we as administrators came on board to say you need to proceed, we then received the advice from the DTI in hand. We then, you know, we focused resources into prevalence of gambling and problem gambling, which would be anyway beneficial to ourselves and also the industry. So that's what happened with the research. For example, even the one we planned this year on online gambling, yet again we have consulted the DGI to give an input in the provinces into our business case before we publish the RFE. DGI has gone on to even give us or will commit to give us financial support if we need further funding for that particular research project, because it will assist the DGI and NGV. So that is basically what has happened and how we work in, on research. I'll hand over to, let me just take the chairperson's question. With respect to the self-funding model, the self-funding model comes from Section 27 of the National Gambling Act, where we have the mandate to provide the central electronic monitoring system. This has been in place over the past 13 years, and we've had one operator in that respect. As was seen in the preliminary findings of the forensic investigation, and it was a matter that was being looked into as the nature of that contract. So initially, that contract was concluded in terms of the 1996 Gambling Act. Now, in terms of the 2004 current National Gambling Act, there are regulations where the National Gambling Act is obliged to collect the monitoring fee. So the monitoring fee is totally separate from taxes and levies that the provincial licensing authority would collect, and there's an obligation on the National Gambling Act, National Gambling Board, to collect monitoring fees. This has not been happening due to the legal nature of the existing contract. And why we then speak self-funding model is the fact that considering the revenue that is generated currently from that contract and from the LPM industry, if one looks at that amount, it's basically three times the amount of the National Gambling Board's grant, which is used from the DGI. And the plan basically, yes, is to go out on tender as we have just indicated to the previous honorable member, and appoint the next operator as a service provider. That would then basically, you know, bring back or rather empower the NGB again to manage the monitoring fees, and it's something that's permissible in terms of Section 74 of the National Gambling Act, where we are permitted to, we are allowed to be funded and operate our mandate from even fees that we then charge or derive. So that's where, that's how we then put forward the issue of the self-funding model. It's something we're working towards. The DGI, from a finance perspective, and Treasury has taken note of that in our MTAS submissions to say, ultimately, if then we are able to implement this, yes, in future, possibly, we could be self-funded. So that's something we're working on. And then I'll hand over to the CFO to take Honorable Williams' questions on the savings irregular expenditure and the BE status.
Thank you. Good morning, Honorable Members. In terms of the legal costs, there were savings that we had for legal expenditure. This was due to the NGB utilizing the services of a state legal advisor as opposed to private law firms. So that was in relation to the 1 million of savings that we had. In terms of the vacant positions or the positions that we have, and we have identified the people that would fill in these positions would most likely be legal people, by virtue of the fact that the NGD has a national inspector division that it has to form. And in terms of the requirements for those posts, it would be most useful for them to fit the legal criteria or for them to have legal qualifications. So it's just a little bit of a distinction between the two. At that point in time, when we had the legal posts, we didn't earmark them specifically for legal people with legal skills. In terms of the key challenges that we've experienced in quarter three, two of them related to the collection of gambling statistics from PMAs. In terms of movement or improvement of how we've managed to address these challenges, between communications or regular forums that we have, or various forums where we communicate with PMAs, our IT forums, our CEO's forums, will be able to collect statistics. We have our national registries that we're trying to get off the ground, and that's the basis of our collecting our stats. It feeds back into the statistics that Ms. Kuma was presenting earlier on, so there has been movement and improvement in terms of the way in which we get information from PIAs. Vacant positions was the second challenge that we identified in quarter three. Progress against that is we have filled in five positions since the previous quarter report that we tabled. There are four new posts that will be advertised, or will be advertised before the end of this month. Those are the posts that we've earmarked for predominantly for legal skills or expertise. In terms of the 1.9 irregular expenditure, the irregular expenditure there mainly relates to expenditure prior to co-administrators coming into office. The only expenditure that was irregular expenditure incurred was as a result of contracts that were already in place and we had to pay out after services were received. Those contracts subsequently were cancelled. So if you're looking at it, there has been no new irregular expenditure that has been incurred since, I would say, the end of September 2014.
Thank you.
Question, I think there's one question I didn't answer. It was basically on the role of the Minister of the DGI in terms of
an NGB in terms of policy formulation. The NGB definitely is an implementer of policy and then laws that have been passed with respect to gambling. But then in this area, in the challenges that have been coming through on provincial national legislation, in the new national gambling policy, or in the proposed national gambling policy, there has been recognition and there appears to be agreement coming through that in instances where provinces are recommending proposed amendments to their laws, these matters will go to the National Gambling Policy Council, where the minister sits, and other provincial MSPs are there. There will be consideration so that we then find our way in terms of avoiding conflicts in national and provincial legislation. Then those policy or legislative proposals would then go to provincial legislature to pronounce on. So the policy is trying to deal with this. Another thing that the policy has introduced was recognition of the National Gambling Regulators Forum. It's not a legislative forum, it's a collaborative forum between the National Gambling Board, head of the National Gambling Board, and then all chairpersons of the provincial boards. So we basically have a CEO forum, which is not a legislative forum, it's just to manage stakeholder relations and maintain relationships and speak areas of common interest. Then there's also the chairpersons forum, which is the National Gambling Regulators Forum. So all chairpersons of provincial boards and the NGBF again would meet quarterly after the CEO's forum. And we are trying, what is in the policy then is that these matters would, if there are any matters to be raised, would then go through the CEO's forum, the chairperson's forum, and then to the National Gambling Policy. So the policy has tried to steer and find the way in which then provinces and national government can all speak before then matter of policy and legislation in the gambling industry find their way to the minister and all provincial MCs. So I was just trying to answer that.
Thank you. Hugh?
Thank you very much, Chair. I think we can respond to Honourable Pierce's question about the forensic report. The department hasn't yet received the final report from the service provider. There have been a number of interviews that have happened, and he's still anticipating the final report. We have requested it from the service provider, and we are in discussions with him, and we'd like to wrap up this matter as soon as we can. Thank you, Chair.
A follow-up.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a few things I want to follow up with. Firstly, I'd like to know why was the contract or the RFP for the NGS project withdrawn? And are you recommending to the DCI that when a new RFP is published, that it is explicitly stated that the percentage I can't remember if you can just clarify, is it the percentage on turnover that the NGB gets, or is it just a set fee? I think it's 100,000 rand maybe per year or per month, I can't remember. But will you be recommending that a percentage of turnover or a fee which will give you that ability to become self-funding is put in into that RFP? And I think the critical thing for the DTI and yourselves, remember is that the longer we wait to do that, I mean, the longer we have to use tax funds to fund the NGB, and I think it's quite obvious that it can be self-funded. But also more importantly, if that process doesn't start now, I guarantee you will not be able to complete this process by June next year. Just to develop something like that requires an extraordinary amount of software developments to develop a new system, if that is what's going to be required, or alternatively, I don't know whether someone's just going to take over the existing system. My question to Ms. Scholes for our question is, have you given service providers a deadline by which to
shipment that I'll report to us, and when that is done, will that report be made available to this committee? Thank you.
Over to Ms. Kongo.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was just confirming with the CFO reasons why the RFP was withdrawn. It was before my time, I'm not too sure. But what I was informed is the previous board members indicated they had to consult with the minister in that respect, and that's the reason why it was withdrawn. But I have not come across any further information why it was withdrawn. And then in terms of what it is we are recommending in the RSP and linking it to the shell funding model, to begin with, as I was trying to explain, the NGB is mandated to collect monitoring fee by virtue of the fact that it should provide the central electronic monitoring system. So that's in the law. What's also in the law is that every licensee should pay a monitoring fee. In the regulations, it's clearly set out that a licensee should pay, depending on the number of LPM machines that are operational. The NGB then collects, for example, if the machines are up to 10,000, the NGB then collects 6% of the monitoring fee. We don't see putting that in the RFP because what the intention is to appoint the next operator as an ordinary service provider, as any ordinary service provider will be appointed to provide a service. In this instance, it would be a system to be provided. So that's basically what the law requires of us. And when we go to the PSMA and procurement, then if there are goods and services, then require you to ordinarily appoint a service provider to provide something that, you know, as an NGB are not able to provide. So that's as far as I can take it.
Here's the point. That contract is R1 billion a year, I think. That's what the service provider makes. You get R100,000 a year. There's something very wrong with that. And that's why I'm asking, are you going to recommend an RFP that percentage, or however they work it out, whatever amount they want to put in, is going to be changed? Because it cannot be that the service provider has R1 billion a year contract, and the NGB is only getting R100,000 out of that. Because if that changes, that's when you sell funds.
Through you, Chairperson. The CFO may assist, but I'll just answer first. The contract is approximately R120 million a year. And then, yes, indeed, we are trying to step away from the contractual provisions as they are in going forward. And hence I was explaining that the contract was concluded in terms of the 1996 Act, and it indicated that the NGB could completely outsource. So the nature of the contract currently was in terms of that Act. The current service provider, in terms of the 1996 Act, was allowed to charge taxes and levies or fees, I've forgotten the correct wording. And on that basis, yes, that resulted in the NGB only getting R16 per machine, which amounts to approximately R200,000 each year. So we definitely would not be wanting to conclude on those terms, and hence I was making emphasis that as we go along, we are obliged to do everything as the 2004 Act permits the NGB to do, and that's what should find its way into the RSP as the law currently stands. The CFO can expand.
Thank you. Just to add on to what Ms. Kong has indicated, the essence of the RFP going forward would be that the NGB would receive 6% of gross gaming revenue that is collected by the service provider on a bi-monthly basis. So that's the basis of it. So we receive all of the money, we would be paying over a fee for services rendered in terms of a normal contract between a service provider. Thank you, Chair. Just to indicate to Honourable Person, yes, we have set deadlines. If deadlines have been missed, the service provider indicates to us that the report is going through some internal quality assurance and quality control processes, and that, but I have escalated this to CEO, and I'm hoping that I'll get a response shortly. Thank you, Chair. Oh, and I think once we get the final report, is due process in the department, it gets discussed with both the Director General and the Minister, who would then consider, and he would then advise on way forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, members. And if there are no follow-up questions or clarities, thank you very much, Ms. Kong, and your team for the presentation. Well, if there's no other further things now that we should do, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you.